You're listening to the Denver Real Estate Investing Podcast, where it's all about helping you grow your Denver real estate portfolio. Here's your host, Chris Lopez.
Welcome to our third episode. This episode is different from our first two, which were interview-based. This one is a recording of a webinar that Charles Roberts and I just finished hosting. This is actually the first in a new series that we're calling our monthly roundups. These monthly roundups will cover important and interesting topics from the previous month. The topics will range from news articles, market updates, interesting data points, and just stories from our day-to-day investing activities. Think of it as a virtual, let's grab a cup of coffee and talk real estate for a bit. We want it to be interactive. We want questions. However, I know it's really hard to always make live webinars, or even for that matter, have the attention span of sitting through an hour-long webinar recording posting to YouTube. So that's why I'm posting the recording to our podcast channel as well. My hope is that you'll make the live webinars to hang out, ask questions when you can, and when you can't, you listen to the podcast recordings. So if you have any feedback, suggestions, or questions, please email me at chris@denverinvestmentrealestate.com. So view the show notes and links at denverinvestmentrealestate.com/podcast3. Here's the show. So the first topic is actually a new investor success story. And Charles, I'll let you dive into this one because you're on the ground with our investor. And I think this property just closed on, it was this Monday or last Monday?
It was this Monday, 3 days ago, I guess.
Okay. So I'm going to pull up the spreadsheet here, and I want you to kind of give the background on you know, how we found the property, the numbers, and why we selected this property.
Right. So this was a newer investor, young couple, real smart, had read a bunch of books. We met up a few months ago, and, you know, they have a baby, and they just want to build a portfolio over time, very conservative, very logical. So we purchased a property on East Tennessee Circle, which is in Aurora South, a relatively, nice area, and it just fit our profile quite nicely. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-bath. They were asking $184,900 for it, paid full price for it, somewhat competitive bid, but we got it. Strong lender letter, just did all the little things right. Good communication with the listing agent. And the downside to the property is it has a relatively high HOA. The HOA was $398 a month. So it's one of those things you think about. I actually had a conversation with one of my agents this morning who is looking to buy a property with a high HOA, and he was really freaked out about it. And I said, look, the point isn't the HOA, the point is the return. And that's based on the purchase price and the rent and all the other things. So if the $398 scares someone away on this East Tennessee, that's great because the price is so low that it was a solid 7.2, 7.3 cap rate. And it was really ready to go. We had a very motivated seller who was looking to buy another property. So they let us know they were going to make this property right for us. It just fit our client's portfolio. They picked it up. They're getting it rented now. They figured about $1,750, $1,775 is what we're thinking. And it's just a really, really solid single base hit, easy first property for my folks.
And Charles, you were telling me, I think it was a couple weeks ago, you kind of had a curveball thrown on this property from the HOA, right? That could have affected the underwriting?
Yeah, it was a really interesting situation. We were using Joe Massey from Castle & Cook, who's obviously a very close colleague of ours, who's a great lender. And make a long story short, he called me a couple of weeks ago and said, Charles, something I've never quite seen before. He said the HOA decided to actually allow the residents a 3-month where they didn't have to actually pay the HOA. They had enough money in their bank account. They just told people, don't pay us for 3 months, which you would think is a great thing. Well, it turns out from a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac agency loan perspective, that was a problem because what it meant was Fannie Mae requires that 10% of the HOA funds go into reserve funds per month. And the fact that there was no money put in through this curveball. And I actually would have bet the deal would have fallen apart. And we would have to tell the seller, guess what? You have kind of an unsellable property right now. As it turns out, much to all of our surprise, Castle and Cook, they said, nope, we understand what's going on here. They basically did an override and they accepted this loan. But, you know, welcome to real estate. Joe's done thousands of deals. So have I. Never seen that one before, but we got over it and life is good.
Well, it's nice to see when companies can take a break from the black and white rules and use some common sense and say, you know what, this still makes sense. So let me ask a question to our audience here. I'll just run through the numbers real quick. So purchase price was about $185,000, put 20% down, and that was at a 4.75 interest over 30 years, estimating $1,750 a month in rent. HOA dues would be about $4,700 a year, insurance $500, taxes $845, repairs and maintenance $600 a year. And so that comes out to, what was that, like a 9% cash on cash return and 7.2 cap rate. So, of course, all properties have pros and cons, or all deals, I should say, and every investor has their different, their different goals. Our investor was looking for, hey, the first property, more turnkey, something easy to get into and build long-term wealth. The people out there listening right now, what are your guys' thoughts on this deal? Something that would meet your criteria or not? I'm always interested in learning from other people. So put in the comments there, and we'll circle back around in a minute as to your thoughts on there. Thumbs up, thumbs down. You know, what are you seeing out there in the market right now? So is our next topic. And this actually is what Charles and I were talking about for a couple minutes before we actually started the webinar. Really interesting article that Forbes published on July 19th. And it was titled, Data Proves REITs, Real Estate Investment Trust, are better than buying real estate. So let me give you, I highlighted two paragraphs from here. Let me read those and then we'll talk about it. So this is from the Forbes article. REITs have a long history of outperforming direct real estate investing, and the trend is expected to continue. For example, from 1977 to 2010, REITs have returned more than 12% annually. This is in comparison to the roughly 10% return of the S&P 500 and a 6-8% return of private real estate funds during the same period. And over the last 5 years, REITs have an average annual return of around 9%, while the average annualized return of direct real estate investing is at or below 8%. So that's the end of the quote I pulled out of there. Charles, what are your initial thoughts on here?
So yeah, Chris and I were just talking about this. And the truth is, what I just said to Chris was, I don't understand this at all, because I believe there's one or two things going on here. Either they literally don't understand what internal rate of return is for owning a property, which is impossible because it's Forbes, they have to know this, or they're deliberately, I don't know, misleading / lying for the purpose of a headline, which again, is Forbes. I cannot believe they're doing that, but I actually believe it's one of the two. So the problem is this, what they're doing is they're comparing apples and oranges in a way that is just a complete freshman error. What they're doing is they're saying REITs, which are awesome, have returned 12% annually. Great, buy REITs, that's cool. That's a great return. That's an above average return. I love REITs, REITs are good. But then they're saying, they're comparing that to a 10% return on the S&P, that's cool, and a 6-8% return of private real estate funds. Now, I literally don't know what that means, but for the purposes of this discussion, I want to compare the 12% to REITs to what they say in the next paragraph, saying the average annualized return of direct real estate investing, because I think I understand what that is direct real estate investing, meaning owning real estate. I don't know what real estate they're talking about, but I'm assuming what they're saying is during this period of time, it's been the appreciation for real estate has gone 8% or below up. That's what I think they're saying is REITs have returned 12% annually versus whatever category of investing in real estate has been 8% or lower. And they're trying to make a point that maybe it's better just to have REITs. Well, there's an enormous problem with that, because you don't just make money from the annualized increase in the price of property. Obviously, you make money by cash flow by the appreciation, but also by depreciation savings, and also by a number of other things, paying off the loan, et cetera. So some of you might be sophisticated real estate investors. Awesome. Some of you might be somewhat new to this. You don't know it, but that's why you're here, to understand a little bit more and to be able to actually challenge Forbes and say, Forbes, you don't have this right. Now, if it's okay, Chris, I'd like to change presenter and show something.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull up the CCIM spreadsheet, which is a relatively sophisticated, I'm not going to do that. I'm actually going to pull up just the spreadsheet we use, which is also sophisticated, but just a little bit easier to understand. Okay, so this right here is a property that I bought, okay? And what I could say, for example, is that right here in the inputs, I put in a 6% annual appreciation. That's my best guess, 5 or 6% over the next 20 years. I think that's what they're using in comparison to the REIT. But that is ridiculous, because that is not an apples to apples comparison. What I would argue is an apples to apples comparison is something we call internal rate of return. And the internal rate of return compares the actual return based on all the different categories of how you're making money on real estate. So what I want you to see is, when I have a 6% annual appreciation rate, 5% vacancy, 4% annual rent increase, et cetera, the first year internal rate of return on this property was 38.4%. Just think about that. I believe they're comparing REITs to the 6%, when in fact, I made 38.4% on this property in year one. This is the property I bought a year ago. So it's dumbfounding to think that they could make that mistake, or to think that they're being deliberately misleading. But this is something, Chris, maybe we should actually do a class on, is the difference between appreciation and internal rate of return. Because you guys who own real estate, have owned real estate for a while and don't play around with the numbers, you probably don't understand IRR, but you do understand how much money you've made in real estate. What I can do is go back and show you how and why you've made such an incredible return on real estate by simply looking at the internal rate of return on your investment. That's the answer. And I think Forbes is, the nicest thing I could say is they're ignorant or misleading.
So I'm going to loop back around to a couple of questions here we got on the spreadsheet from the deal we just purchased, or the deal we helped the investor purchase, Charles. Because we IRR, I agree with you there. That can be a rabbit's hole, and that's a whole class on itself. So if you got questions on that, post them. So let's see, going back to the spreadsheet. Okay, so Jennifer asked, where can we get the spreadsheet? That's an easy question. Go to denverinvestmentrealestate.com and go to resources spreadsheet. And if you can't get it on there for some reason, just shoot me an email, chris@denverinvestmentrealestate.com, and I'll shoot you an email back. So Leslie asks, I think your spreadsheet is a bit light with the $600 a year for vacancy on the rent you have listed. Secondly, there is nothing listed for utilities or lawn care. I still think it was a good deal that will appreciate nicely if it was a single family home. So I believe for the lawn care, that's probably part of the HOA, right, Charles?
Yep.
Yeah. Utilities, I imagine some are covered by the HOA and the rest are covered by the tenant.
Yeah, this is an attached property. This particular one I just used as an example was one I bought in First Creek. So I'm paying no utilities. I'm paying HOA, which is $180.
Sorry, Charles. We're talking about the spreadsheet from the deal we just closed on Monday.
Gotcha. Sorry about that. So again, attached properties, so there's no utilities. This gentleman is going to manage it himself, and that's why there's no property management. The reason we put 600, this is actually what he wanted to do. I agree with you. In a typical situation, that's probably quite light. The reason he felt confident here is he's a pretty handy guy. So in his situation, he'll do some work if it needs some plumbing or this or that ongoing, but the place was immaculate. It was perfect. And he felt that, you know, 600 is about what it's going to be. I have 2,500 tenant months of doing this. So over time, I would actually put about 600 for myself as well, just because I do have a lot of experience with these types of properties, and it's not as high as you think. You're basically paying the HOA to take care of a lot of your problems. But the number one thing for you, whoever asked this question, is take our spreadsheet and put whatever you want into the spreadsheet. The The point wasn't to try to sell you on this property. We're not. It's already sold. The point is to show you the exact numbers that the buyer put in, which I felt were appropriate for him and this particular deal on this particular property.
Let's see. Michael asked, I think this is a similar question. Good morning. I noticed no cost for property management and no utility cost. Are these not factors for the analysis? Also, this assumes the property was rent ready. Was it?
Yeah, everything you said is right. So property management, he is managing it himself. If you're not, put in 8 to 10%, work with a property manager. No problem there. Utilities, I think we talked about, we're paying an HOA, and it's quite high HOA at $398. So that's all getting sucked up by the HOA. And yeah, the place was absolutely perfect, immaculate, rent ready. Just, you know, I'd live there today. So this was just this particular deal. And what I talked about earlier was it was a 7.2 cap. It's a fine cap. It's acceptable. It's a single, it's a base hit, not phenomenal. But one of the reasons we like this property for this newer investor is exactly because it was ready to go, because he didn't want to do the work, not really good at it, doesn't have any experience. So theoretically, we could have gotten a 7.6 or 7.7 cap and bought a property that needed more work if he wanted to take that risk. He didn't. So we bought a reasonable 7.2 cap, but it's completely turnkey and ready to rent.
And I know, I mean, from all the real estate books and, you know, websites I've read over the years, I know a lot of them say, well, even if you manage the property yourself, you still have to put the property management into your analysis spreadsheet. And you know what? That's their opinion. Just depends how you analyze a property. Personally, if I'm going to manage my property myself, I don't, because that's really still cash in my pocket. Now, if I plan on hiring someone, yeah, I'll put it in there. Again, that's just something for you to decide and see what works for you. So let's see, another question on here. So Jennifer asks, is it best to run your numbers on a cash on cash return, cap rate, and the internal rate of return before buying the property?
I do that one.
Yes or no question, but Charles, why don't you take that?
Yeah, I love that question, because the answer, as it is so often, is it depends on what you want. And what I will tell you is that there is no perfect answer. Absolutely not. Whichever book you read or guru you talk to, it depends on what you want. I personally like cap rates. I'm just comfortable with cap rates. It helps me compare all the properties that I see and in my life. And I know what a 7.2 looks like. I know what a 6.6 looks like. And when I see an 8.1 at 9 at night, I'm going out and looking at it right then, because I jump when I see something in an 8 cap. What I would say is this. I would spend some time getting comfortable with one metric. I don't think you're going to be a better investor by understanding beautifully, perfectly three or four metrics. Yeah, you know, you might feel a little better about it. And great, if that's what you want to do, it's fine. But most importantly, I would say just choose one metric. Cash on cash, I would say about two-thirds of my clients tend to favor cap, and about a solid one-third tend to favor cash on cash. But I'll tell you something crazy. A gross rent multiplier is the simplest possible metric. It's the purchase price divided by the monthly rent. So if it's a $200,000 property and you get $2,000 a month, it would be a 100. Simplistic. And that's a, you know, that's a harsh term. It's not simple. It's simplistic. And yet I had a client last year who MIT grad, MBA, just the smartest guy, PhD in some science that I can't even understand. He had $2 million. We ended up buying 16 properties. And you want to guess what metric he liked? He liked gross rent multiplier. Cool. That's what he was comfortable with. So the answer is just get comfortable with one metric and then be able to understand how that metric applies to what you're looking for. That's my best piece of advice.
That's a great piece of advice, Charles. I mean, I personally like the internal rate of return because I think it gives you the complete picture. And, you know, from my point of view, I've always been curious as to why a lot of these real estate investing books I've read over the years, you know, they say don't take into account depreciation. Don't take into account the tax savings you get as well, which doesn't make sense to me because you know what? That's going to be more money in my pocket ultimately. I mean, right now, I've been self-employed my whole life, and I just calculated what I'm currently paying in tax when you factor in everything I have to payroll myself. I'm at the 51% tax bracket if you take in federal, state, Social Security, both sides, a couple other fees. Yeah, I might consider taxes when I buy something because that's 50% right there. It's a lot of money. And so to me, it makes, in my perspective, why wouldn't I consider that as a factor? Because that definitely moves the needle for me.
Okay.
Let's see here. Just sorry, reading the next questions here. So Charles, Jessica, or I'm sorry, Jennifer asked, what would a phenomenal rate of return be for you?
Well, I bought six properties in the last year and a half, and I bought them because they had, you know, phenomenal rates of return. I didn't even need to buy one. I bought one and I just kind of jumped on the wagon. And what I was getting for IRRs, I just showed you one. It was like a 30% first year internal rate of return. And that's why I bought them, because they were really, really solid. The one that on Tennessee, I don't know if we have it. Oh, is this Tennessee right here that we're looking at?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so this one right here, I just called a single. I called it a base hit, a solid, relatively easy property. And this one has a five-year IRR of 19.5% a year. So that would be what I would consider a completely acceptable internal rate of return. And those numbers are incredible. To go to phenomenal, I'd say 30, maybe 35% first year or for the first 5 years averaging out. That's really, really good. Typically, you are going to take some more risk, though. You might be in a lower end neighborhood. You might be buying a property that needs some work. There are reasons why you have to sort of, you know, pay for that additional wealth building in terms of risk. But that gives you an example of one that we bought that, you know, in the world of real estate investing, Tennessee was about as low risk as it gets, you know, and that's a 19 and a half. So to answer your question, 30, 35, phenomenal, a 20 for a five-year annual IRR, very doable in this market. That's why we're still buying properties.
Oh, here's an interesting question from Jeff. How might you factor in a decline in rent rates X number of years down the road?
Well, the way you do it with spreadsheets is you're projecting, and that's a scary thing because you're guessing what's, yeah, right there. So right there, we have annual rent increase of 4%. Why do we use that? Because that's the 45-year average. It's not even as high as the average annual inflation rate. So we just say, look, we don't know what the future will hold. We're not smart enough to be able to predict the future. No one can. So we'll just go back to the 45-year average and put 4%. That's what I use. That's what my clients tend to use. Let's say you know something we don't know. Great, put 1% or 2%. I don't care. It's your analysis. If you think that rents will only go up 2%, then great. Send me an email. We'll send you the spreadsheet. Use it. Put 2%. I think that's as unlikely as saying it's going to be 6% only because, you know, 45-year average. That's the number we have to work with. But there's no more science than that. It's a guess, and we're guessing it based upon history.
All right. I think we're caught up on all the questions at the moment, and we're going to jump on to, let's see, what is next on here? Okay. Oh, here we go. So I actually just completed my first flip. Actually, it sold, let's see, July 14th, so about 2 weeks ago. And a year ago, I had zero intention of doing any fix and flips, just not on my radar, and just don't have a whole lot of interest in it. But a really good opportunity came up with a family member of mine. So I decided, you know what, good opportunity, calculated risk. Let me hop on there. So just a quick, and I'll do a more detailed write up of this later, but here is a before picture of the kitchen. Just give the feel for it. It was a 3-1, so three bedrooms, one bath. And so that was a kitchen, and that's the after. Sorry, I didn't have the most recent photo, but you get the idea of what we did. So total kitchen remodel. And we ended up actually converting. There was a water heater room right as you walked into the house. So we actually made it into a 3-2. So we took the water heater, moved it to utility closet outside, which required us to move an electrical panel and put some insulation out in the that utility closet now as well. So it made it a much more functional property since now it went from a 3-1 to a 3-2. So main things we did was update the kitchen, add that bathroom, redo the other bathroom. The rest of the house was in pretty good shape. We put a new, laminate flooring throughout most of the living area, new carpets in the, bedrooms. The one wild card we had was we had budgeted a couple hundred dollars for plumbing, but we came to find out the whole plumbing was shot. So $3,500 later, we put new plumbing in there. But one of those just fun things. So let me pull up the numbers here. All right, so quick rundown of the numbers here. Bought the place for, it was like $184,900. So we'll just say $185,000. We had estimated $19,000 in fix-up cost, and we closed on that March 10th. And so I did take out a hard money loan for this, or I guess it was not a complete hard money loan. I did put 10% down. So I got the 10% interest rate and had to pay 2 points. So 10% down at 10% interest rate with 2 points. And so basically 2% of the amount we borrowed, which was the fix-up cost and the purchase price. So going to the calculator here. Oh, and before I do that, so a couple of curveballs happened. Like I said, the plumbing, which, you know, we expected there'd be a few things to go over budget. We actually ended up spending about $10,000 more than we had planned. The plumbing was a good chunk of that. Electrical cost more, but also it just, a lot of materials just cost more than we estimated, or prices had gone up. You know, granted, we had a few other things we had to fix up there and there. So it's just lots of little things. So we ended up going about $10,000 over budget and taken actually 6 weeks longer to complete than we had anticipated. And the reason is because the family member I had partnered up with on the deal had a health emergency about halfway through the fix-up cost, the fix-up of it. And he was a guy on the ground. He wasn't doing the work himself, but he was there, you know, making sure the contractor's there, doing the work, running around, grabbing parts, checking on things. So he was just the boots on the ground, making sure stuff was getting done and all those little odds and ends. So he was the hands-on project manager. So he, obviously a very key player. Well, he had a health emergency and just, you know, he had to take care of his health, totally off the radar, which I understand. And they're just, you know, horrible timing from that standpoint. Luckily, he's everything's back on track now for him. So luckily, his wife stepped in and just made things happen, was able to pick up where he left off. Yeah, I mean, it took a little bit longer, cost a few more dollars. But the fact that she was able to come in, complete the project and still get things done was just amazing to me. So one of the things that I learned, or not that I learned, but that I got reinforced as I was doing this deal, was that don't get totally focused on the numbers. Make sure you have that people element in there as well. I know it's very easy because I come from like a stock market background, is what I've spent quite a bit of my life doing was the stock market, which is all numbers. And real estate, it's very easy to pull up a couple spreadsheets and we live and we die by numbers. But I know a lot of people, myself included, we take out that human factor on there. And you can't put on paper, you can't quantify on a spreadsheet how important it is to have a person that can just get things done. Like, how do I put them in the spreadsheet? I can't. But having that in the mix is so important to me. And it's one of those things that you can't show on the spreadsheet. And yeah, I'd rather make less money on a deal if I've got a key person on there that can help get things done. Someone like me, just, hey, if something goes bad, I'll be in there at 3 o'clock in the morning. I don't want to be, but I'll be in there at 3 o'clock in the morning. Do I have to, if it means getting the deal done or getting things done in time? You know, just roll up my sleeves, suck it up, drink a gallon of coffee and get things done. That's what my partner was like. So our return, we sold it for $265,000. And so our selling cost and everything were about $13,000. Total interest on the loan, not including the points, was around $5,000. And we had so just so you know, it was $51.08 a day we had in our carrying cost for our interest-only payment. Our $10,000 extra over budget, you know, we put about $20,000 down. So we made just under $25,000 on the flip. So I'm not a big fan of ROIs for fix and flips. I don't think they mean a whole lot since it's a short-term deal. But $25,000, I was extremely excited about. So Charles, I know you used to do a lot of fix and flips. I know you don't do them anymore. What are your thoughts on these numbers on this deal? Like, you've got experience. This is actually the first time Charles has seen the numbers and gotten the details on things.
You know, you made money on your first deal. Like, hurrah. I think that's fantastic. I used to do a lot of fix and flips. I don't think I was very good at it. It's just what it comes down to. I don't know. There's probably a whole bunch of factors, but I'll take responsibility for it. You know, market went down, this and that, but forget about that. I just don't think I was particularly good at it. I think I thought I was smarter than I was, and it wasn't something that I should have been doing, and I got myself into trouble. And I get to see a lot of people who go to a weekend seminar and talk to a guru and think they're going to, you know, change their life, and they'll do a fix and flip, and it'll be a disaster. I mean, I think you said like $10,000 additional fix-up costs. Hey, good for you. You know, like that's a good deal that you were only off by $10,000 if you are not a very, very sophisticated and experienced investor. So I know I'm sounding negative, but there's a reason why I don't spend my time doing fix and flips. Like, I'm in a pretty damn good position to do fix and flips for myself. You know, I know a lot of people. I know a lot of contractors. I've got the money, pay cash for stuff. If I thought that I could make more money with reasonable risk doing fix and flips, I'm a logical person. I would be doing it, but I'm not, because I don't think that I can and take on the level of risk I want. So that is just one person's opinion. It just explains why I'm a buy and hold guy, and I tend to work more with people like that. I think it's wonderful that you made money in your first fix and flip endeavor.
Yeah, and I was actually like, when I told my wife, you know, she said, what's the goal of the property? I said, the goal is to not lose money. I said, this is our first deal. I said, we're gonna have to pay our dues. We're a freshman in college this year. There's a chance we'll take on some student debt while we pay our dues and learn things. So part of me, I don't like having an attitude going in because I don't want to be like a negative Nelly. But then the part of me, the practical side is like, you know what? First deal you're doing, there's a learning curve. You have to pay your dues at some point or the other. So I was ecstatic that we actually made a profit. And I, you know, more importantly, I learned a lot from this deal. And probably like a lot of people on here, I know everyone's experiences, but I've read my fair share of books, talked to people. As you know, it's always different from reading something and watching something and doing it yourself. So let me just check the questions here.
Yeah, I'm looking at them. I think we're caught up on questions as far as I can tell.
I think actually I see one more new one.
Okay.
So Jennifer asks, I want to buy my first investment property, but my fear is that I screw up on my numbers, or maybe my number analysis is wrong. What do you recommend besides reviewing it again to make sure that my numbers are valid? Are you getting a second set of eyes on there? That'd be my first question, because your concern is completely legitimate. And it's good to have that concern, because that, you know, shows you're thinking about from different angles. Get a second set of eyes on there. I mean, you know, and if you're working with a realtor, have him or her look at it. Have a friend look at it. Email me or Charles. We're happy to look at it and see what we can do to help you out and give you a second set of eyes on there.
Yeah, and Jennifer's a realtor. She's one of our folks. So, Jennifer, I appreciate it. Do me a quick favor, Jennifer. Tell us if you're talking about a buy and hold or a fix and flip, because I'll have different answers.
Buy and hold.
Okay, so Jennifer, for buy and hold, just run it by me. Like, throw it by me. Let's sit down. Let's talk. I mean, this is what I do, is I want to try to help. And I'm not going to be perfect. You're not going to be perfect. But what Chris said is right. Another set of eyes. Let me take a look at it. Let's run it around a few more people. And also, by the way, understand that, of course, your numbers aren't going to be right. Like, yes, that's the whole point. They're not going to be right. They might be better than you expect. They might be worse. But this is real estate. And one of the things you learn really quick in real estate is it doesn't matter if you have a 200 IQ. You're still going to be wrong in your numbers. What you have to do is feel comfortable with the risk you're taking and understand you might be wrong in a good way or a bad way, but at least, you know, another set of eyes and some perspective, happy to help with that.
Great. All right. So let me go back to my notes here. Oh, so Charles, I know you and I were talking about this a couple of weeks ago, and I find it very interesting. I know other people will as well, but you just recently moved your real estate portfolio from holding it in your name to moving it to LLCs. And I'm sure there's a certain structure to it. And I know I've had this question, and it's a common question for newer investors of, well, should I incorporate first before I buy the property? What do I do? Obviously, there's a lot of moving parts in here, Charles, but talk about why you did what you did.
Okay, so first answer is, I am neither an attorney nor an accountant, so go talk to your attorney and accountant. Pregnant pause. Okay, now let me just tell you about me. Like a lot of you, when I first started investing 20 years ago, I bought every book on real estate investing and I learned everything I could. And one of the things that is in the books for the right reason is talking about asset protection. I understand that. I chose, for the right or wrong of it, not to go down the path of asset protection. So just so you know, I've owned a lot of properties and I have a reasonable portfolio right now. And until now, all of them were in my name. Which is like a really bad idea if you talk to any attorney. Like, I'm the ultimate guy that you wanted to sue, but haha, too late because I just changed it all. So for the first 20 years, I had everything in my name. I got good insurance. I got an umbrella policy. I was a little bit good and a little bit lucky. I've never been sued. I'm a really, you know, I'm a hands-on property manager. I get along with my tenants, all that kind of stuff. But I also got lucky. Nobody ever sued me. But I finally got around to, you know, kind of like growing up a little bit. And I just paid an attorney, a really good local attorney, Stephanie Long, who I can refer you to. You know, I just paid like $4,000 or whatever, which is, you know, money. I hate spending money. I like making money and I hate spending money. And I just paid her thousands of dollars to move all of my stuff into LLCs in a basic structure where I have like a master LLC and I have all the little LLCs underneath it. And yes, I could have done it for $50 an LLC. I know that. I could have gone to the Secretary of State, but the fact is 20 years later, I still haven't done it. So I finally just decided, yep, it's time to do it. I have too many assets to be playing around with it. So this is a decision you have to make. But here's what I think is a mistake, at least in my humble opinion, is that a lot of people spend, you know, their first year and a half in real estate doing asset protection, no real estate, and then they end up having a great asset protection scheme and fail in real estate because they don't do any real estate. Just don't let that happen to you.
So, I mean, was there anything, a particular thought or something happened that made you move the needle and decide to incorporate, or is it just finally got around to it on your to-do list?
The latter.
Really? Huh.
Yeah, no, I've like I said, I'm like, man, throwing salt over my left shoulder. I've never been sued. Nothing ever came up. It's always something that I've thought about. And, you know, I just kept delaying it and delaying it. And one of the reasons I delayed about 6 months was when I started to look at the process, I talked to my insurance agent and it turned out it was going to be very complicated because suddenly my agent was saying, you can't put them in LLCs and have the normal insurance you have. You now need to go to business insurance. I'm like, oh, shoot. Are you kidding? Now I've got to spend more money on business insurance. But I went to a second insurance carrier I have with Safeco, and Cindy said, nope, we're fine with it being in LLCs. So there was a delay because of that. But no, nothing happened. I just decided I needed to do it.
So your insurance premiums for the, you know, the property insurance actually did not go up?
Correct.
Wow. That's good to know.
Yeah. And I, you know, I looked at this very carefully. Let me go back to, I hate spending money. So this is what I look at.
All right, moving on. So this is a question oddly enough, I don't know, I guess things come in three, but about finding and hiring a mentor. So it was about 2 weeks ago, and I'm not exaggerating, within over a 3-day period, I had three separate people from the website email or call me and asking, hey, Chris, do you have recommendations for, you know, mentors around the Denver area? You know, I want to find a mentor that I can either work with or pay to get mentored. And this is all, you know, towards investing. I think one was towards wholesaling. The other two were towards learning how to be investors. But they're out there looking for a mentor. And I've got a very mixed feelings about hiring mentors. And this comes from previous businesses I've done where I've hired mentors and I've had some successful ones. And I've also, frankly, just wasted a lot of money. And what I've seen a lot of times, I'm stereotyping here, there's some great mentors out there. There's also some people just, hey, they're happy taking a $10,000 fee from you. And, you know, you're not getting any better advice than you're getting from a YouTube video or reading a couple of books. Is that, you know, what typically happens is the mentor will take the money, but how much are they really vested in your success? You know, hey, they got their fee. Whether you go out there and make a deal or make money, they still got their fee. Now, they may have to return some of it if you throw a fit about it, or you may cancel your monthly coaching program with them. But I always think about that is, hey, this person's getting paid whether I'm successful or not. And that, it's not a red flag, but it's like a yellow stoplight. It makes me pause and think, okay, do I want to go out there and actually follow through with this? Now, I still hire people. I would call more consultants when I need a specific problem. Like, hey, I'm running a new Google AdWords campaign. Years ago, I ran the big problem and I spent close to $10,000 on a Google AdWords consultant to help me with an advertising campaign. Because at the time I was spending $10,000 a month on ads. And so I ran the problem, my ads died. I had to get it fixed. It was a very specific problem that was worth $10,000. And I've had friends over the years spend $10,000 on a real estate coach or a stock market coach and it's been a complete waste of money for them. And so I brought this up to Charles, I think last week when we were putting together our agenda for this, and he and I were talking about it. And, you know, there's basically three types of mentors: people who've never done it, people who did it, but it was 20 years ago and now they retire, or people that are still currently doing it. So my recommendation is that if you're out there looking for a mentor, make sure it's someone that's currently doing what you want to learn from them, and not someone that's just, you know, acting like they're a coach. Or, hey, if someone did this thing, as Charles, you said, like, hey, great, you were a successful investor in the 1970s in Ohio. Wonderful. Good for you. Why am I going to hire you now? This is 40 years later. So, Charles, what advice do you have for people out there that are, because I'm sure you get this question probably weekly, like, what advice for people looking for a mentor?
Yeah, it's a tough one, because there are good mentors, there are bad mentors, and it's really a one-off. I've been asked many, you know, times over the years to be a mentor and, you know, to actually get paid for it. And I just always felt uncomfortable with it, because I feel like, well, I don't know, I can be your agent. That's sort of what I want to do, and I want to help you build a portfolio. I think you should look very carefully. I have to tell you, gloves off. The $30,000 a year mentorship programs from, you know who I'm talking about, from Trump University down, I am not fans of those. And if I'm insulting a few people on the call, great, you know, throw the questions out, throw the answers, we'll read them live, okay? But I can tell you that me and my colleagues in the business, and I talk about my friends from Pine Financial, my friends from other companies in town, we literally have seen a negative correlation between the more money spent on mentorship fees and their ability to do real estate. And I'll tell you why. What we find is that when you start paying 10, 15, 20, 50,000, you have a set of expectations that you have spent so much money supporting that you can't do anything else. And I kid you not when I tell you, I'll take 3 minutes. And if I can't get through to the person what they can do in this market, I will very, very politely suggest that, you know, go find someone who's a better fit. I'm uncomfortable talking about this, but that's what I've seen in 20 years in this business, and that's what some of my colleagues have seen. If you're an exception, terrific, and that's great. So, you know, we're being asked, you know, hey, you know, who could do mentors? Can you do mentor stuff? And we're kicking it around. I don't know what we're going to do. We're just having an honest conversation. We want to be able to help people. You know, this is business building stuff for us as well, and we want to work with more people. And I'm looking at the list of people who are on this call. A bunch of you are agents that work for the companies that I run. I want you to be thinking about this too, about how you want to handle your business. The fact is, we're not sure what we want to do. All we want to do is make sure we do it with complete integrity. And that's a roundabout answer. You got to figure it out yourself.
And I got two more points before we move on. We move back to the spreadsheet. So, you know, you talked about $30,000 for mentorship. This property that, you just helped the client purchase, put $42,000 down. Is that $30,000 better saved towards a $40,000 down payment, or $30,000 to a coach to motivate you and rah-rah you? I would think everyone would agree that, you know what, that money is better spent on a property. Because you know what? You know you're getting your money back. You're buying an asset. You're not buying a rah-rah pep rally. So always think about, hey, if I'm spending $10,000 or $20,000, you know what? That's a long way towards a down payment on a property. The other point I will share with you, because part of the reason I've had success in various businesses over the years, non-real estate related, I've been very fortunate in finding mentors. But I don't want to say I've been lucky, because I've been out there busting my butt, basically knocking on doors, cold calling, and just saying, hey, who can I talk to, who can I meet, and who can I go out there and find and make a win-win situation? And I've been able to find really good mentors to learn stuff, because I brought value to the table and I made their lives easier. And basically, hey, I made that person's life easier. They started teaching me more. They started, you know, sharing more details with me. And then I always set up, hey, if you help me make money on this or do this, you know, I'll give you a slice of my pie. I'm not a greedy person. Like, I'd rather make 80% or 70% or 60% of a few hundred thousand dollars over the next couple of years, rather than 100% of making $10,000 or $15,000. So if you're out there searching for a mentor, go in there with the mindset of, hey, what can I do to make the mentor's life easier, because I will get help back. I will get some love back from that person.
So yeah, let me add one thing to that. So for you guys who aren't agents, let me tell you something that I learned early on. Truly, the best agents out there have a choice of people who they want to work with. And while nobody's going to be as impolite as I am right now, I'm going to tell you the truth. They're going to work with the people who just basically think how Chris just said, that they want to work with. Yes, that they can make money from. But I cannot stress enough how we want to make our lives nice and fun and easy. And we just don't work with people who are nasty and mean and going to make our lives difficult. We want to work with like-minded people. One of my best pieces of advice for a new agent is get a team together and really be respectful of the people on your team, and you will get respect from them. It makes such a difference, and you can work with the best person in town. If you're a nice person, if you bring value, if you take things on yourself, and you just make everyone's life pleasant. That's just one of those things that you don't read in the books and I can't put into a spreadsheet, but every agent knows that, especially the agents who've climbed the ladder and have the choice of people who they want to work with. They want to work with people that will help build their business and that they're going to have pleasant times with, because they're going to actually build their clients' wealth and everybody's going to be happy. It's so important.
So hey, Chris, another
you in the background with your little two-week-old?
It is. She's only 1 week old. So
everybody, Chris's wife had a baby a week ago, and I hear the baby, and let's all congratulate him because this is his first child.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's been fun. The next article to talk about here was a recent article from the Wall Street Journal called Passive Migration: Denver Wins Big as Financial Firms Relocate to Cut Costs. So the third time I read this headline, before I get into it, I finally understood why they were talking about passive migrations. So for those of you that are familiar with the stock market or invest in there, there's active investing, where you are paying a hedge fund manager or a money manager to go out there and pick stocks and buy money for you. And they keep a percentage or two for their services. A trend the last really two decades, it's growing, is passive investing, saying, you know what? Rather than me paying someone to go out there and pick stocks, I'm going to go out there and just kind of pick a whole basket of the S&P 500 and not pay someone. And that's called passive investing. So that's where the play on words came from, was passive migration. So because a lot of the investing styles of the people out there are changing, it's also having an impact on financial firms, which relates to Denver, because a lot of them are moving to Denver. So here's the article, or a quote from the article. Charles Schwab is emblematic. Since announcing its relocation strategy in early 2013, the company has shrunk its San Francisco headquarters to fewer than 1,300 people, a 45% decrease. Its 47-acre campus south of Denver is now its largest office, employing almost 4,000 people. So this was something perspective for the rising prices of Denver real estate. So continuing on the article, for Will, a Manhattan native who moved to Denver 7 months ago, it's his first time he's ever lived in a house with a yard. So moving from an apartment in Manhattan to a nice house in Denver. Erica, who left New York 5 years ago and works for Janice Henderson, says she nearly wept when she realized she would have a washer and dryer in her own apartment. Jessica has met more than a dozen other recovering coastals since moving in Denver in 2013. And it goes on to say, if you're talking to someone who's been in Denver, they'll say, it's getting unaffordable. But if you're coming from San Francisco, it's the reverse sticker shock, and it's wonderful. She and her husband bought a four-bedroom house in the city's Platte Park for $680,000. Friends back in San Francisco paid almost twice that, so $1.2, $1.3 million for a two-bedroom apartment. Now the people in Denver have a yard for their son to play in, and their second child is on the way. Or I'm sorry, was just born in June. So some perspective there from where you're coming from for the rising Denver prices. And before we talk about the article, I think this is just another thing in the favor of Denver's real estate prices just keep going up. Hey, I'm coming from California. Denver is cheap to me right now. It's still cheap, just like all these other people's now. So Charles, I know you've been in Denver for a long time. Have you noticed these financial firms moving there? What are your thoughts on all these companies moving to Denver and the impact that will have?
We have a lot of data that projecting the overall growth of the Front Range. We hit for the first time ever 3 million people in the Front Range Denver Metro in October of 2014. And we're increasing by about 50,000 a year. That's births over deaths, incoming versus outgoing. And it's projected, and be careful because these are projections, but by state demographers, it's projected to increase by about 45,000 people a year, almost a half a million people in the next 10 years. So look, you live in Denver, you hate the traffic. I got it. But maybe the flip side to it is you hate the traffic because people love moving to Denver. And if they move to Denver, they have to live someplace. And, you know, that's one of the many reasons I just bought six more properties, because I want to have places for them to live. So there's simply no question that there is a lot of growth in Denver, and I believe it's going to continue.
So that's all the tidbits we had and topics we had for this month's roundup. So if you got any final questions, go ahead and post them in the questions and we'll get to them. But just to recap, the recording will be available at the website. Just go to denverinvestmentrealestate.com/webinar2. So I'll post the video there. I'm also going to take this and post it to the podcast. I like to have options when I listen and review to things. So I'm going to provide you guys the exact same thing. If you can watch a YouTube video for an hour, hey, you've got a better attention span than I do. I can't make it more than 5 minutes in the video. But give me a 3-hour long podcast, I'm in heaven, and I'll listen to it all in one day or a couple of days. So, you know, try both. See what works for you. But we will be doing these monthly roundups every month going forward. So we want to make them better. If you've got feedback for us, email me, chris@denverinvestmentrealestate.com. Let me know what you like about it. Suggestions. You're not going to hurt my feelings. I've got thick skin. But also, please bring your questions. We want to make this like an interactive, kind of like an interactive online community. So please bring your questions. And as the ball gets rolling and we have more people hopping on with more questions, we'll have some guests on here as well to answer questions. I think it'll just kind of turn into a fun, educational way to kind of stay up to date on what's going on in the Denver market and just learn about things that, you know, otherwise we wouldn't learn about it. So that's why, like, Charles and I want you guys to send questions into us and send things that you see, because a lot of times it'll be the first times that we see it as well. And we love learning and educating ourselves. All right, Charles, any final comments before we wrap up?
Well, I just want to thank you, Chris, for having the idea to do this. I'm always a little worried about doing stuff that is not like completely data centric, because that's where my head is. But this was great. We had a huge list of people on this. I appreciate everybody staying on. Thank you. We'll continue to do this. If you like, please send us suggestions. We have so much fun doing this. Please let us know when you want to hear. We'll catch you on the next one. And one quick announcement, Jim T, who I know is listening, I did just get a confirmation for the property we're looking at noon. So I have the lot box. So if you're still good, I'll plan on meeting you there at noon.
All right. Well, Charles, thank you for coming out, or thank you for your time. And everyone attending this webinar, thank you for sharing your morning with us. All right. We'll see you on next month's webinar. Have a great day, everyone.